On the last episode, Scott Tsuchitani confronted the San Francisco Asian Art Museum's 2004 exhibition, Geisha, Beyond the Painted Smile, an exhibition catering to the Orientalist fantasy of Asian mystique. Scott made his own posters, replacing the face of the geisha with his own, and flooded them into the public consciousness through his guerrilla art.
And then what has been the role of the museum in doing that? Not just this museum, but the role of the museums in Western civilization from the beginning has been to celebrate imperialism and colonialism, right? How do you interrupt that? If you think of that regime of representation that's normalized that thinking, and part of the way it normalizes that is by erasing those histories of violence and of domination.
I have been hired to help suppress the rebellion of yet another tribal leader. Apparently, this is the only job for which I am suited. For 6 months' work, I am to receive 3 years of captain's pay, teaching Orientals to soldier.
What can the general tell me about this man, this samurai, Katsumoto?
And so Asian Art Museum of San Francisco also followed up with its own blockbuster release. It presented its own Orientalist male counterpart exhibition in 2009, The Samurai, a sequel of sorts of the cultural tropes of what it means to be Japanese from a Western imperialist perspective. And because of the previous project, with the geisha exhibition, Scott now has more lead time with a new network of insiders and intelligence network.
So this is a big difference between the geisha and the samurai. Like with the geisha, we're talking about, would people understand it and what reactions came? And I mentioned the email reactions, but in general with that one, I felt like for a Bay Area audience, especially for Asian American women, I did not have to explain a thing. They would just get it. Asian American community would get it. Feminists would get it. Because that fetish was just so big during this geisha boom in culture, and women were living with those effects. I got testimonies from people telling me that Asian American women go on dates and the guys expect them to act like submissive, subservient, sexual way of the stereotype.
Why do Chinese girls taste different from all other girls?
You think we better, huh?
No, just different. Like Peking duck is different from Russian caviar, but I love them both.
Darling, I give you very best duck.
Well, that'd be lovely. We have had some interesting times together, Ling.
The samurai is different because it's a warrior archetype. It's not just something popular in the West. It has a meaning in Japan, which, interestingly enough, is sort of a transnational meaning that's been generated between the U.S. and Japan historically, as well as in Asia and among Asian Americans. And so I had to take a different approach for that one, which involved some call intellectual activism, or in this case, tapping into good scholarly critical work to try to make it legible and leverage that in the project as part of the art. So kind of using scholarship as art. And then tactically, because if the chops are there in terms of providing the evidence, right, the fact-based evidence, that makes it harder for the museum to dismiss.
How does one leverage the authority of scholars? How do we leverage the knowledge that is produced in academia around the subject of geopolitics in East Asia and the US involvement? So again, Scott begins from a visual image, a parody of the existing rack cards that the museum produces. And additionally, this time, he also produced a website.
This was 2009. So in between the two projects, I learned how to make a website because I kept hearing, oh, you're an artist, you need a website. So I took a free adult ed class on HTML, CSS, and I made my artist website. And so as this project was approaching with the samurai and how to do it differently, it's like, oh, I can make a parody of the Asian Art Museum's website. Also an exhibition page for the samurai and just pack that thing full of knowledge as a way to counteract the erasure of history, the erasure of knowledge that I saw the museum performing by basically aestheticizing samurai as high culture at a time when we were 8 years into a war in Afghanistan. So military culture as beauty in a time of war. What does that mean? And why is it okay? Well, it's okay because it's oriental, so it's removed from where we are now, right? It's seen as this remote, exotic thing. Yeah, so there was the rat cards, which we could not put in the museum this time because they knew about us very well by then. So those went around Japantown. Then they were disappearing really fast, and I couldn't figure out, they're not that interesting. Why are they going so fast? I used to go to this grocery store. It's now gone. It was a historic grocery store in Japantown, Japanese-American grocery store, started in 1906, called Uoki Sakai. And so I went there where I knew the checker. The checker is the one who was the source for the geisha poster when I did that original intervention. He's like, hey, how's it going? I'm like, well, I'm doing this new project, but I can't figure it out. My flyers are disappearing really fast. And he said, oh, museum guy was just in here. And so I'm like, oh, damn. They're the ones taking my, they're removing my materials from Japantown. As an artist doing this work, it's performative, it's playful. So I had a blog accompanying the website where I could then do like play-by-play articles. And so I did an article. It's like, hey, this museum is stealing the work of an Asian American community-based artist.
As they're celebrating the aestheticization of Orientalism on war and violence.
So it's another opportunity to keep the thing going. And so since there was a website, and since there was substantive critique, and since there was entertaining artwork, so it was like a multi-layered approach, like multiplicity, simultaneity, to try to get beyond the cognitive defenses again, to draw people in who might not even agree with what I'm saying, to preach beyond the choir that way, to try to get in a spectrum. And since it's on the internet 24/7, it can go globally. So it grew that way. And I had a site meter and I would track the web traffic. And typically you just get IP addresses, but sometimes you get names of institutions instead of just an IP address. So I was able to track over 130 universities, more than 30 of them from outside the US that had visited the website.
Everything ranging from the Japanese consulate to cultural institutions in Germany.
On the blog, there was a place for dialogue, and that started drawing comments, including from someone who worked in education at the Smithsonian. People told me that there was another Asian Art History Forum, curator of Japanese art from LA County Museum, had come out critical of their shows. And then eventually it sort of grew enough that that's when the academics started blogging about it favorably. And I felt like that's it. Like once that happens, that gives a stamp of legitimacy. And the museum has to, not just among academics, but among their professional peers, this is a real thing. Then also in the art press, like Art Newspaper in London did a story on it. A class in University of Auckland in New Zealand, Japanese lit class, was using it as point of departure for discussion. So multiple impacts, multiple audiences, globally dispersed, a blog of expats in South Korea. It's funny, yeah, a lot of people like that one assumed that the people behind it had to be Chinese or Korean or Chinese or Korean American, like anti-Japanese. So this idea that there's no room for complex engagement with stereotypes, that you're necessarily going to take this polarized position. So in response to how do we do this, I try to complicate it and provide nuance as a way of opening up possibility for informed dialogue and debate, as a way of generating new discourse that can transform that regime of representation from multiple perspectives, not a binary. So there's multiple stakeholders, and to create platforms for that, for people to participate who are otherwise don't have a say in the conversation, right? Usually it's just one-dimensional, the museum, or there could be academic conversations that the public doesn't see. And so this is a way of what they call like a pluriverse of ecology of knowledges, right? Multiple perspectives as a way of countering that the coloniality of knowledge, which is centered in a Euro-American perspective around race and gender.
You mentioned a book by Huan Tan Nguyen, A View from the Bottom, which examines the portrayals of Asians and more specifically Asian American men in Hollywood cinema, European art films, gay pornography, and even experimental documentary. What are some of your own findings from that book around the topic of Asian masculinity?
Yeah, I think an earlier book I was influenced by also was David Eng's Racial Castration, which is also about Asian American masculinity. A big thing I got out of that book came from Bell Hooks, which is the way to intervene in these things and way to transform them, you want to make sure you're not reproducing the same logic structures that drive them in your attempts to intervene in them. One of the things about Asian American masculinity that I've seen in Asian American media, the late Jeff Adachi, who was a public defender in San Francisco, was also a documentary filmmaker. He did a documentary, I think it was called A Slanted Screen, about objectification of Asian American men in cinema and media. But it's sort of, it's critiquing that representation from the standpoint of victimhood in terms of transformation. It's still from a position of wanting recognition, wanting visibility within that representational system. If that's what you're wanting, that means you're willing to actually turn a blind eye to how racist and sexist that system of representation is. And that system that has objectified basically anyone who's not a white man in certain ways, but especially most of all women of color, but also men of color. So Miki was talking about the data from dating websites that show that, yeah, among heterosexual, that black women and Asian men are the least desirable. So I think it's important to look historically at how that desire has been constructed in order to understand how you want to relate to it and whether or not, or how you want to intervene in it. Because if you look at the construction of black women in cinema from the very beginning, it was always sort of repulsive and ugly and something that many black women did not want to identify with, which led in a way to the oppositional cultural production of independent feminist black cinema.
Yes, Lord, got to get out.
The Mammy.
You tell me who you want done, and I'll do the hell out of it.
The Jezebel.
Shut it up! You are such a big baby!
And the Sapphire. Submissive, sexy, sassy. Three stereotypes of black women that return to our screens over and over again.
The Mammy is probably the most familiar to people. It's usually a maid, heavy, taking care of the family.
You is kind, you is smart, you is important.
She is asexual, she doesn't have really a life of her own. She's really only there to support the family.
And probably one of the most famous examples is Mammy from Gone with the Wind.
Just hold on and suck in.
Somebody who is always seeking out to put aside her own desires, her own needs for white families, white men, white women, white children.
Meet Sugar Hill, sexiest, deadliest chicken town.
The second stereotype is the Jezebel, and that's someone who's generally oversexed.
Is mysterious.
Her only power is in her body and in the influence she has over men.
Unattainable.
And then finally, the Sapphire character, I think that's seen in TV more often than anything else.
Get some Kleenex, wipe your nose, cause it ain't that damn sad.
The Sapphire is usually sharp tongue, manipulative woman who emasculates her husband.
On the other hand, what we've seen in Asian American media is still an aspiration for recognition in the same system. And maybe a abhorrent example of that was by Daryl Hamamoto, who was a professor who did important scholarship around Asian American media representation, but then later in his career came to the position that the way to respond to this denigrated image of Asian American men in mainstream media is to produce Asian American pornography featuring Asian American men with Asian American women. Then a student make a documentary about it. There's all sorts of ethical questions, because this is a professor in Asian American studies at UC Davis who did this, and then to have a student produce a documentary about it. So, but from a cultural politics standpoint, that sort of epitomizes that misguided logic of we're going to objectify Asian American women in straight porn as a way to try to climb our way back up to be equal with white men. It's reproducing the same cultural violence. I think rather than reaffirming the categories that commit violence against us to begin with, that objectify us, it's to queer those categories, queer those practices, or to destabilize those meanings, to open up the fixedness of that regime of representation to new possibilities. Like I mentioned, that Christmas card I did, that was 2003. And I was responding to these regime of representation around cisgendered heteronormative family life and also part of the model minority. And that was the first year that both of my siblings had children coming into the holidays. So I mentioned I'm a middle child. So both of my siblings had married other Japanese Americans in straight marriages, and they were both suburban homeowners. Basically, they had all the markings of what we were supposed to do. And at that time, I was in my early 40s, unemployed, community college, starving art student. And I could feel the pressure, that normative pressure within my family. And so it's like, how do I make room for myself within this system, be treated with dignity and respect? And you might think of family as something personal, but it also operates as a social system or social structure, just like any other institution. And so my response was to make this Christmas card that looked like a Walgreens or drugstore photo card, because every Christmas I would receive so many of these photo cards of my friends and their kids, or just the kids, but, you know, and I love my friends and their kids, but there's sort of a normativity to that. And so I was like, well, I'm going to make my family. And so I searched on an image bank on the internet for ideal Asian American family and found a backdrop of a photo of a couple and their, you know, their older son, younger daughter. And I superimposed in Photoshop my face from photos of myself at ages that suited those bodies. And I sent it out as a card to about 50 friends and relatives, without explanation, all in the same day. And then a day or two later, when I came back from studio class, my answering machine on my phone was flashing full of messages. And people my age, my generation, found it hilarious and brilliant. And then my parents' generation friends left messages that were somewhat congratulatory, because they took it at face value. It set off a chain reaction of phone calls between aunts and uncles about, why weren't we invited to the wedding? Now we got to go buy a wedding present. And so it's that relational aspect of the work that it begins with the artwork as an object, but then the issue of what art can do that is really interesting, right? So instead of making a thing, it's making things happen. And so eventually those calls would reach my parents, who just thought it was hilarious. The card brought a lot of joy and opened up space in the family that lasted for years. I had uncles who would, when I would see them, you know, over the holidays, hey, how's your family doing? You know, so that was an example of kind of queering family expectations. And then the following year was the geisha, where I'm queering gender and what geisha means and who am I. So with the Samurai Project, I engaged with gender in a different way, in that there I saw the museum presenting this ideal of warrior masculinity. And I thought, well, what did that actually look like in that historical practice of sex and gender? And what I discovered was that a formal part of the training discipline was what we call pederasty, or age-structured sexual domination, where the youth who are training, they even had different hairstyle, different forelocks, would assume a sexual bottom position for the certified samurai, if you will. And then once they reach samurai status, they shave the forelocks and assume a more dominant position. And so I played with that in the project. This is a way to try to challenge or destabilize that toxic investment in masculinity and that warrior archetype. The title of my project, instead of Lords of the Samurai, which is the museum's title, mine was Lord, It's the Samurai, Myth, Militarism, Man-Boy Love. So I made reference to that in the project under the heading Boys Before Flowers, which you might know as a popular, it was a manga and drama in East Asia as a header. But then the content was about the history of that practice and how it was celebrated by the Hosokawa first daimyo, the first lord of that clan, and Hosokawa being the family whose collection comprised this exhibit, family of a former prime minister of Japan. And so it's all documented in history going back to Tokugawa period. And I wasn't shaming it, I'm just putting it out there like, well, this is part of it, so let's acknowledge that, right? Let's stop this erasure. I mean, there's a humor aspect to it, right? Myth, militarism, man, boy, love. What the hell is that about? That project sparked more outrage than the geisha did. Well, it cut much deeper because the level of the substance to it in terms of epistemology couldn't be ignored. Whereas the geisha, the actual content of it was pretty limited, right? It was more symbolic.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel has called on Russian President Vladimir Putin to pull back his forces from Russia's border with Ukraine. The White House says Russia now has more troops there than at any time since conflict broke out in eastern Ukraine in 2014. The buildup has fueled fears of new fighting, but Russia insists that it is the victim of Western provocations.
It is the heaviest fighting in years, and militarily, it is one-sided. Israel's precision airstrikes have destroyed the offices of Hamas leaders in Gaza, and they have killed top Hamas commanders. Inevitably, civilians, dozens so far, have also been killed.
In Taiwan, authorities fear drills are becoming reality. Taiwanese pilots scramble American-made fighter jets to practice responding to Chinese military incursions. Taiwanese soldiers practice defending their island from would-be Chinese invasion. Taiwan believes Beijing is preparing for war. The Chinese military recently released this video of Chinese drills simulating amphibious assaults. And almost every day, Chinese jets cross Taiwan's self-identified airspace defense identification zone. Never before have so many Chinese planes come so close to Taiwan. Senior Biden administration officials tell PBS NewsHour they do not expect an imminent invasion. But in March, the outgoing top U.S. military commander in the region predicted war was coming.
I think the threat is manifest during this decade, in fact, in the next 6 years.
So some would say that power is everywhere and that it's not possible to have a truly horizontal power structure. And lately we're witnessing acceleration and push in militarization around the world. How would one argue against the aestheticization of militarism?
Yeah, these are good, big questions. So in terms of power is everywhere, right? It's in every relationship. The idea is not to eliminate it. So in my work or in cultural studies, we're looking at unequal power relations, especially structures of dominance. And so when it's about representation, you look at how that works and how can you intervene in that to make it into a more equitable situation. And so looking at how these binary oppositions on which stereotypes are based are rooted in trying to create fixity. So culture is actually always, as you know, it's always constantly changing. It's like a constant flow of discourse, and it's always being contested. But dominant power works is to try to fix things with a certain meaning. And that's why these Orientalist discourses are dangerous, because part of that is this idea that things don't change, that the Orient has always been this way, and reproducing these tropes of the geisha and the samurai is fixed in time and part of the essence of who we are today. One way to intervene in that is to disrupt that fixity of meaning. So today, as we're more polarized today, as you point out, it's a different cultural terrain than the project I've been talking about. It's more fraught in certain ways, especially with the way the social media works now and the organization of the far right. So I don't have any clear answers for that. But just in terms of a general approach, it's not to reproduce that same logic by coming back with an oppositional response that's just the binary mirror of what's objectified or racialized you, to change the cultural terrain.
So where do we go from here? I feel that we've been living with an ever-increasing sense of alienation and disappointment in our society. And if the construct of masculinity has been so focused on objectification and the binary, which provides the lure and the illusion of power and meaning, is there a way at all to escape these binds?
The question of how do you create a sense of belonging that doesn't require the denigration of other people? So how do you establish a sense of who you are if you're male identified in a way that doesn't objectify women? Or if you're straight identified in a way that isn't homophobic? And I think as you're pointing out with this polarity and the return to tribalism, what we are seeing is massive changes calling these longstanding categories into question, especially around whiteness, around patriarchy, And so as those categories are threatened, you're seeing a retrenchment among those who benefit most from those old categories. And the logic with which they benefited from is based on the exploitation of others. So then it's hard to envision another world where you can belong that isn't based that way. But the new communities that are forming are based on a consciousness that that doesn't work, because we can never belong if we reproduce those logics. So we need to grow and figure out ourselves. How can we all coexist where there's room for everyone, where it's not based on violence, in order for you to feel like you have what you need? And if your needs are met because of a system of violence, what does that mean? And is that something you want to continue to perpetuate?
The Hungarian parliament has just passed a law in the past few minutes that bans what is described as the promotion and portrayal of homosexuality and gender reassignment among those under 18. The right-wing government of Prime Minister Viktor Orban says the law, similar to one enforced in Russia, protects children from gay propaganda.
It entails a frontal and blatant attack against the freedom of media and freedom of speech, as well as children's rights and LGBT rights in Hungary.
Scott Sujatani is an artist and PhD candidate of cultural studies at UC Davis. You can see more of his work and the references we discussed on AsianProvocation.com, where you can find also links to Scott's work at scottsujatani.com. Special thanks to Miki Dezaki for introducing Scott Sujatani, which has resulted in this special four-part series of Asian Provocation. Music credits include Wave Saver, Enigmatic, Curved Mirror, Philip Ayers, Ian Luxton, and myself, Ayuta Taraxia. Special thanks to Liv Phoenix. Asian Provocation is researched, mixed, and edited by me. This is an independent, listener-supported podcast. You can be a part of this channel by donating at asianprovocation.com/support, as well as on patreon.com/asianprovocation. I've got some great guests coming up in the next episodes. Here with you until next time. It's a dream haunted.